Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm really pleased to be joined today by a repeat guest. We've had him on the show before, Rod Blackhurst. And very exciting new guest. Never had him on the show before, but I've wanted to talk to him for a while. Ethan Suplee, the actor. And star of Rod's new film, Dolly, which is hitting theaters this week. Then it's going to head on over to VOD and Shudder. Is it just Shudder, or will it be on VOD too?
No, it'll be on VOD like at the end of March. You know, I mean, like minimally 3 weeks from now, like, is when it could first hit. If there's a lot of demand, you know,
go see it in theaters. This is a good horror theater movie. But guys, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonny. Thanks for having us. By the way, I think it's a major oversight that I've never been on your show.
I haven't wanted to go through Rod and be like, hey, I gotta get Ethan on. You know, I try to save the favors when it's an emergency. But I'm really happy to have you on the show. Of course, Ethan has been in tons of movies, tons of TV shows. My Name Is Earl is on that for a long time. We're going to get to Dolly in a second, but I was saying to Ethan, I did want to ask a few questions about his early work. And the only one I'll go with right now, and we'll maybe come back to it a little bit later, is how many people still come up to you and say Sailboat and or Schooner, Ethan? Because that is Mallrats, very formative film for me. That was a big one.
It's kind of bittersweet too, because when I'm often presented with like a Mallrats video jacket or DVD sleeve, and people ask me to sign it. And my favorite line from that movie is "You dumb bastard," which I got to say to a little kid, which I just thought was so great. And you know, Kevin Smith liked it so much that in what will hopefully be Mallrats 2, he just needed to find a way for me to be yelling at little kids again. And so he made me I'm now the security guard in the cop in the mall, just so I can yell at kids. But people really want me to write "It's a Sailboat, Not a Schooner." People love that so much. That movie was, I thought everybody involved, I thought you do a movie and that's it. You know, it was like 1995. We did this movie and I was like, we're all movie people now. We're not TV people. We have made it to the big time. And like four people saw that movie in the theater. And yet we just did a 30-year reunion. And thousands of people came out, and you know, I talked to from you know comic book people to military people who checked the box so they could have Mallrats with them on every deployment because it was their comfort. To a guy from Blockbuster who said it was the number one rental at his Blockbuster for many years in a row. Just like it's insane that that movie had the legs that it had, because it was such a disaster in the theaters.
All right, let's talk Dolly, because Rod, you were kind enough to send me a pretty early, or I guess not an early cut, but an early-ish cut of the film. I watched it and I was pretty impressed, because you made this on a shoestring. In Tennessee. Right. This is all shot kind of in the backwoods, in the hollers. I like to do this sometimes. Give folks the elevator pitch for Dolly. How do you get folks in the theater to see this movie?
Yeah. Okay. Well. First of all, I want to say this. Like, I love hearing these stories out of Ethan, because I'm just a kid from. I could have sat here and listened to Ethan talk about this history, because I'm just a kid that grew up I'm 45. I grew up in the woods of upstate New York, and I always wanted to make movies. I grew up without a TV, and movies felt dangerous to me they felt like contraband, or like I had to go to great lengths to obtain them or to obtain a viewing experience. And so getting to like make movies, getting to make movies with people I like, and to hear about movies and Ethan's made so many, is just, I just kind of want to sit and hear the stories sometimes too. So please forgive me. Like I'm just like thinking about Mallrats, and even of course the first time I saw Mallrats, but the elevator pitch of Dolly is, Dolly is a grindhouse and and David Lynch inspired horror movie about a young woman who's kidnapped by a monstrous figure who wants to raise her as their child. It's a, you know, a love letter to films that have shaped me in my life. But it's also, I think, you know, as a creative entrepreneur trying to figure out how to plant a flag in the ground and wave it, you know, proudly for what I hope and aspire to do as, you know, as an artist and as an independent filmmaker. And Dolly's like, you know, we've landed on the beach and we're staking a foothold and we're going to charge forward from here. So yeah, that's Dolly.
Let's talk about actually making this thing, because it is, like I said, it's, you know, when I say on a shoestring, we're still talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not cheap to make a film. You sit down, you write the script. How do you raise the money? Where do you get the money from? This is what the young filmmakers I talk to, where do they get the money from? So how did you get, how did you raise the money for this picture?
Well, it starts 10, 13 years, I guess 13 years ago, we made a little independent film well before I knew Ethan called Here Alone that won the audience award at the Tribeca Film Festival. And we made that film for $176,000, and it was, you know, very hard. You know, most of us didn't get paid. Most of us who were like willing, or, you know, the producers, writer, director, we didn't get paid. But you make something and it proves to people that you are not full of shit, right? And that the thing that you felt like you could do, you've delivered on. And then from there you start, those people who invested in that film realize, okay, like you can deliver, and you start to meet their friends. And truly so much of Dolly came from having made that first independent film and then meeting people that knew those investors and those executive producers, and we were vouched for. And then, you know, concurrently, we met a group of investors in Chattanooga, Tennessee, through a friend of mine named Bryce McGuire. And Bryce and I had met in LA years ago. We were both living there like 2011, 12. Bryce was going to AFI. Our wives met at some event in town. And they said, you guys might, you two, you know, you're cut from similar cloth. You're like cockroaches who will figure out how to survive the film industry apocalypse. And Bryce and I got along very well. And we made things together when I lived in LA up until 2014. And Bryce and I had made a proof of concept, or it was like, you know, like basically a jump scare called Night Swim that became eventually the feature film Night Swim that Bryce directed for Blumhouse. But, you know, again, when you're putting together an independent feature, you go back to the people that you worked with and helped you figure out where to begin. And so for me, that was the crew from Here Alone. And that was Bryce McGuire, who introduced me to some of his friends in Chattanooga. And next thing you know, we're shooting a movie, you know, 2 hours south of Nashville. But it really, you know, again, it took, I couldn't have known that this is where those things would lead, right? Like at the time, you're just trying to make your way and trying to figure out how to be a good person and carry a project forward and meet people and meet people who believe in what you've said you can accomplish.
I would like to add to that, Sonny, because I think there is for sure truth in what Rod is saying, that having something that you can show to people to say, like, we're not full of shit, we can do this, is a big deal. But then there's also the fact that, like, when you go out there with somebody's money, there are many instances, and I've been on a ton of independent sets, where you're with somebody who maybe hasn't done it much, and there's so much fear about needing to overshoot stuff or not understanding how the scene will cut together, or not having a very clear image in their head of what they want. And then you wind up just not being literally capable of, so it's not full of shit, but also, are you capable of making a movie? And I've now worked with Rod a couple of times. He knows exactly what he wants. He understands the mechanics of the scene going into it. He's empathetic with the actors. He never rushes us. And I've never experienced a single day of overtime with him, which is unheard of on an independent film, where there's almost always somebody pulling their hair out going, we're going to have to start cutting shots here. And then the director's got to make consolidations based on that. I've never experienced with that with Rod, which I think is so much more important than just being full of shit or not. Like, you can go and waste people's money, but then he has a real ability to go onto a set and actually pull off his vision on a limited budget, which is like all you could ever ask for as an actor or a producer.
Let's drill down on this for a second. Rod, you look very happy here. You're beaming. You're beaming. That's like the nicest thing anybody's ever said. Yes. Which is, in case you're not watching this on video, we probably won't have video for this anyway. But Ethan, I want to drill down on that a little bit, because you know, what's an example of a day on set on Dolly or on Blood for Dust, say, which is the previous movie that you'd worked on with Rod. I had Rod on the show to talk about that one, where he made a choice that kept things moving that might have bogged down another director who wasn't quite as sure what they were up to.
All right, Blood for Dust. First of all, he fucking. Not only did he have what's it called, the little sketches? I'm blanking.
Oh, storyboard.
But he went and shot. He would go after work or on the weekend and shoot the storyboard on his iPhone with him and the DP. So you could go in and he would tell you the next day, here's what we're looking for. And he would tell you over and over and over, I'm not an actor, so ignore my acting, but just to show you what the shots are and how they cut together, because he shot it the night before, the whole scene. So you could see, like, here I am crouched down behind the car. I've got a gun. I want to cut to this shot over here. Like, you could watch the entire scene before you went and shot it. I've never had that before. And it was so useful, because you get into like a gunfight we were shooting. It was 4 degrees in Montana, snow everywhere. And I'm going, wait a second, we're about to shoot a shootout. There's me and Scoot and two people in front of us. And then people are coming through the back door and we're kind of cut off. And then we go outside and there's a chase sequence. And he's like, yeah, we got to get this before lunch. And I'm like, this is not possible. This is not possible. And then he shows me, no, it's this many shots here. Do you want to see it? He says to me, and he shows me the scene, and it doesn't look exactly the same, but it's shot for shot exactly the same. I don't know if other people do that, but at the same time, I can then sit down with him and go like, okay, he knows exactly what we have to get. Now let's have a conversation about the character. And there's no rush. There's no like, I can't talk to you because there's some emergency over here. I have to put out some fire. He takes the time to like, you know, as an actor, I'm a sensitive guy, and he holds my hand and walks me through everything I want to discuss that really maybe not even necessary, but it helps me feel better about what I'm doing. It's just another way of doing it where, you know, look, I'm not in the meeting with him and the producers before we start the day or after we start the day. And maybe there is somebody pulling their hair out there, or maybe there are fires that are being put out. None of it makes its way to set. So we get to set, and all we're thinking about is the movie and the scene and my motivation as an actor and how the shots are going to work and what it's going to look like and what we're trying to do. It's just a thoroughly creative process where, to be honest with you, a lot of independent films come down to you're giving up the integrity of what you're doing because there's a lack of preparation. And then when it gets down to it, you're scrapping stuff that you really need and wind up shooting a bunch of stuff you don't need.
Having the lack of preparation does feel like the key, right, Rod? Because this is, you know, whenever I've been on a handful of indie sets and there is always somebody running around with their hair on fire, but the director, you know, he has to make sure the ship is provisioned and is going the right way, and everybody is steering. You know, I don't know, oars are going in. I'm the ship metaphor is crashing. But Rod, what is that preparation process like? You're out in the middle of the woods in Tennessee. What do you have there to make sure everything is going right?
Oh, well, I mean, Ethan's very kind here. I mean,
this is just my experience. I know. Well, man,
I really appreciate it. I have to say that, like, again, when you come from nothing and you don't have money, I value and feel the responsibility to take care of somebody's money and time or anybody who has decided to join me on this campaign, right? Like, it's, I don't take that position lightly. Again, like I am, doesn't matter if it's $176,000 or, you know, Blood for Dust was much more expensive, you know, several million. I don't take that lightly. And so I think for me, I go, well, I'm going to be prepared, right? Like I want to achieve this, and I want to achieve it both out of respect and responsibility. I want to achieve it because I want to have, you know, I don't want my time to be wasted either. I want to proudly, like, return from our, you know, our travels, you know, across the wasteland. And I want to come back holding, you know, the riches or the treasure that we found. And despite what people thought we might do, you know, they thought maybe Shackleton would be lost to the ice, and no, we're back, you know? And But I also want to grow and learn. And so the way to do that is to, again, achieve it, right? Is to have it fully realized. So, I'm not the first idiot to say this, but, like, it's just all in the amount of preparation you can do and the ability and obviously understanding exactly what you're doing and why you're doing everything. And then, because no matter who is asking you about it, whether that's Ethan asking about his character and all those things, or why this scene takes place here, right? Like, of all the places, everything happens for a reason. And it's not just because it's cool, right? Or because it's fun, right? Like, and so I don't know, like, I've only had the luxury of making my films and being a part of the producing team of my films. And when they come from within, I think that's just inherent to, you know, the work you're doing, is that, like, well, I know it intimately, and I want it to succeed because it also is mine, but I also have a responsibility. And so it's a combination of all these things that goes into us, you know, all of a sudden being there on set, you know, in the Tennessee heat or in the Montana cold.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about Dolly. Let's talk about the actual film itself here, because, you know, when I texted you, I asked you, hey, can we get a recommendation for folks? What should they watch to prep themselves for this? And you came back with the most interesting answer I've ever gotten to this question, which was High Tension, which is a French, you know, kind of ultra horror. Indie thing. And also the 1937 Snow White, the animated Snow White, the Walt Disney yes. Snow White, which it took me back for a second. I was taken aback for a second with that. And I was like, oh no, that's actually about right. That feels right. What were some of your inspirations or how did those inspire you while you were kind of making the film? What was in your mind as you were writing the script and then kind of prepping to shoot this?
Well, and maybe I'll say this too, that, like, it was always a fairy tale in the way that we had thought about it, which is where the Snow White reference comes from, right? Like, and Snow White is actually a horror movie if it's not in Disney. I mean, a lot of those Disney movies are horrific tales if you're not, like, treating it like Disney does. But the fairy tale aspects of Dolly came alive later, actually. I know, Sonny, like, no one would know this, but you and I have talked about that, like, about the way that we did, like, once the film was in post-production, turn it more into a fairy tale or make sure that mm-hmm. that wasn't lost in there. But that aside, because nobody knows that history except for you and me and now Ethan and anybody listening to this, the true motivation came to write this came from a number of disparate things, kind of like finding themselves creating a Venn diagram. And one of those was a professional frustration in about 2021, going, I'd made two movies and I was finding it very, very hard to make something else. And I was interviewing for a lot of studio jobs and people would say, well, you haven't made a horror movie. How do we know you can? And And I, you know, the movies I'd made were the movies I could get made, the movies I could make. And so I kind of thought, well, I'll show them, you know, like I'll go. Yeah. You think like, yes, Here Alone is a dramatic thriller masquerading in its not great marketing campaign that misconstrues exactly what it is as a horror movie. It's not a horror movie. It's a dramatic thriller. And I was like, well, I'll go make something weird and gonzo and mad. And then they can't deny me that, combined with what I kind of wish I'd maybe done years ago, instead of making a very conservative, well-structured film in Here Alone, was just make something that made people pay attention. I think I've learned in the film business that maybe even more so than being fiscally responsible and making something that could be sold and find an audience, is that like people do appreciate a swing, like an audacious, you know, move. I mean, around that same time, I'd met an incredibly talented writer who had come to us via he'd sent us a blind query online, and his name was Brandon Weevil. And he's truly a remarkable horror writer, horror screenplay writer. I mean, Ethan and I know of this other movie of his called Nurture. That's like one of the most insane things I've ever read. It's fucking insane. And then also at the same time, I knew a woman who was approaching, in my real life, I have a friend who was approaching a motherhood of their own and had grown up the daughter of a monstrous mother, right? A terrible human being who had a lot of problems, and problems that have endured to this day. And as this woman was facing a motherhood of her own, was wondering if some of those things might be present inside of her and whether or not she was going to be suited for it. And she ultimately had severe postpartum, but this was kind of like pre-birth anxiety and fear and like spiraling that was happening because of the ways her mother had used love as control or as a weapon almost to, you know, tell your mom how much you love her and we'll go get dinner. We'll go get fast food, you know? And that like sounded like a nightmare of a childhood. And then now as an adult, like not having a mother and wondering about their own path forward. And so I was just trying to think about all these things and going, well, I need to make something that's audacious, right? That's bold. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I am a product of these films, you know, outside of these films like Texas Chainsaw and, Halloween and The Shining and going, why have I not done that? And it was because I think I was ultimately, and I feel like I'm hogging the mic here, so I'll try to wrap this up very quickly. It's like, I want to make many different things. And I'd been trying after the first two movies to move towards, you know, for lack of a better term, like studio fare, right? Like bigger budget movies. I have a family. I want to be making a living. And it just wasn't working. So I was like, well, again, I'll recalibrate. I'll take a step back and I'll see if I can synthesize all these things into a movie that I can make for the resources I can find and reverse engineer what Dolly became. At the time it was called Baby Girl. I mean, when we were shooting it, the script was called Baby Girl. I mean, Ethan's character like says Baby Girl. People have like realized that when they see his character in the movie. And like, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, but the artist just, you know, a creative person just trying to find their way and trying to figure out like, how do I make something and how can I course correct and grow and learn and apply this to what I love doing and I'm not getting the opportunities elsewhere. So I'll make a new opportunity myself. Even if it's at the time, I remember thinking it felt a bit like a defeat. Like, you know, everyone, Mark Duplass and everybody talks about like the couch and water bottle tour. You make some things and you think for sure, like my phone is going to ring or I'll get to, I'll be growing. And then a couple of years go by and you go, I'm still at the same spot, but that's not good. I want to be making things and I can be making things. So how do I help myself? And that is Dolly.
Yeah. Ethan, this is a movie with some pretty big swings and some pretty intense moments, including with your character. I don't want to spoil anything. This is the thing. I want to dance around stuff here. But so when you were reading the script, what was it that jumped out at you as like, hey, this is, I gotta make this. This is the thing I gotta do.
I've spent a lot of my career playing kind of sweet, kind of unintelligent guys, and the part that I played that I enjoyed maybe artistically the most was this TV show called Chance that was on Hulu. Mm-hmm. That nobody watched, but it was just so meaningful to me because I played tough and I played intelligent. And I'm not suggesting that Toby is intelligent. Toby, the character I play in Dolly, is intelligent, but it's such a departure for me. I think in, you know, I'm a father of four girls. I have a granddaughter. I think I identify as a very nice person. So the idea of playing somebody, you know, even the character I played in American History X, who's he's a bad guy. I think he's a guy who, or the way I was playing him at least, is just kind of a moron who fell in with the bad crowd. But he could have wound up with another crowd and gone in a completely, there was nothing innately evil about him. But I like this idea of like, because I do believe there are some just straight up bad apples here on Earth amongst mm-hmm. humanity. I think for the most part, human beings are decent. But then, you know, there's going to be a couple sprinkled out there that are sociopaths and sadists. And that's interesting to me because I haven't really done that. And so I was reading the script and could just hear his voice in my head as I was reading it. And I thought it was so, it's just such a fun role for me.
It's interesting. It's interesting that you mention making kind of a conscious shift here, because I had noticed something similar in your work with, for instance, Babylon, which is, you know, I'm watching Babylon and I'm like, okay. And then I saw you come, I had no idea you were in the movie. I saw you come on the screen. I'm like, oh, this is an interesting turn of events. What is, and again, you're playing differently, different from type, different from stuff we had seen you in before. And I thought it was really interesting, really, really good. It kind of kicked that whole sequence up a level. Have you made a conscious choice like this as you were looking at roles? Like, hey, what can I do that's, you know, it's just a little bit different. I want to do more.
Yeah. The place that becomes tricky for me is television. So I just did not too long ago, I did a TV series where I think it was a funny TV series. It was for Amazon. It's called The Pradeeps of Pittsburgh, but I'm playing a character that is not a stretch, but TV mm-hmm. is like a 9-to-5 job. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then I can go do movies and try to pick and choose these kind of more interesting, maybe artistically meaningful jobs that come along. So I absolutely have tried to do that simply because I go and do a TV show and play this character that I'm very familiar with and I enjoy the paycheck, but I don't really feel there's nothing inside of me is getting a lightning bolt from doing it. But Dolly was one of my most fun, truly the most fun characters I've ever done, simply because it really is, it's not something I can just turn on autopilot. I have to like mm-hmm. actually think about that and put some effort into it. And it's rewarding in that way for me. Because I want you to believe that guy's not a really nice guy pretending to be a bad guy. I want you to believe he's a bad guy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, again, folks, you should check your local listings. Do people say that? Check your local listings. It's playing in theaters all over the country. Starting Friday, this is going to go up on Friday. So it should be in theaters, by you now. It's one of these movies that I assume would be fun to see with a crowd. I haven't actually gotten to see it with a crowd yet. I got to track down a screening here in Dallas. But you guys have been doing screenings for it. How have audiences reacted? Rod, we were just talking before you came on the show. You had a you had a screening with Fred Durst, the director, of course, lead frontman of Limp Bizkit, you know, who has kind of shifted into directing. He's made a bunch of stuff. How have audiences responded in both like festival and just screening settings?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to, this is going to come across like tooting my own horn or patting myself on the back, but it plays well in a room full of people. Right. And, and it doesn't matter whether people are cackling because they don't know how to process what's happening or cringing. I love going to the movies myself. And again, it was part of the spirit of this project of like, well, cinemas might not exist forever. Well, I'd like to make a movie that could be enjoyed in that setting while they still are around. And it is like magical to feel and to watch happen. I mean, I've been at a bunch of screenings over the past couple days, and we've had two walkouts at the grossest parts of the movie. And I go, well, that was not, you know, I don't want anybody to walk out of there, but like to know that something is creating such a visceral reaction is like damn exhilarating. I'm not going to lie about that. Right? Like, yeah. I'd rather make something that does that versus is milquetoast that is forgettable. Of course, I'm not trying to deliberately gross people out. I think it's just the what the film is, you know, became what it is through the process of making it and through the process of post-production, and those, you know, it's probably crazier and more wilder on screen than maybe it even was on the page, but it works really well in a room full of folks and you're trying to figure out how to respond to it or reacting to other people responding to it. And that's been damn exciting to see. I mean, it's going to be in a lot of screens, so check your local listings. Cause if you go see it and like it, it would mean a great deal. And it would help if you told other people, you know, that too. Word of mouth matters right now for indie films.
Yeah. Yeah, word of mouth. I mean, that is the key here is, you know, this is not there's not a $35 million marketing budget behind this. There's not, you know, ads on in front of football games or basketball games or whatever. So folks, if you see a movie and you like it, tell people. That helps.
I'm making me think about something here, Sonny. You asked about how it played at festivals. And, you know, the film premiered at Fantastic Fest in the fall. And Fantastic Fest is, you know, a prestigious, maybe the most prestigious genre festival in the world, definitely in North America, and has had a long tradition of like putting great genre films on the map. And the, like, I felt so seen as a filmmaker there. It was one of the most moving experiences I've had. And what I mean by that is like, again, I was always a, you know, the weird kid. I grew up in a small town. I didn't know anybody. And in my life, I felt a fair bit of rejection. And I've just kind of kept, you know, forging ahead, right? Like a lot of self-belief and, you know, well, I'll just keep going. And, you know, it's hard in this industry when, you know, the cool kid accolades and the cool kid validation makes it easier for you to do what you do, right? Or to grow, to find something to make or to make a living. And this is not a knock on it. I just, you know, I haven't been allowed to sit at that table in the lunchroom necessarily. So again, going to Fantastic Fest, like I felt very seen. It was truly like one of the most moving experiences I've had. And I don't know. I think everybody wants to be seen for who they are and what they are and what they're capable of. And I also think that what's happening in these screenings right now, and also happened at Fantastic Fest and the other genre festivals where Dolly played, is that you have an audience who is supportive, kind of writ large, but also knows that there's so much more and knows that you're a first-class filmmaker, just like they're a first-class audience. They know that there's intentionality and that these things are thoughtful and there's families sharing genre movies with their kids. And it's a very different ecosystem than when you go to a very prestigious, one of the top five or six film festivals. And there's a lot of people there that you're like, who are you? Why are you here? They're snooty. They're judging you. They think they know more than you. They're like asking you, I don't know. And I'm just going, I don't want to be in that setting. I want to be at Fantastic Fest where the love abounds and not just the love for the filmmaker, but the love for the genre and the love for movies. And I had this moment where I was like, good grief, maybe I should have been trying to get here instead of, you know, wanting to go to Cannes. I do want to go to Cannes, don't get me wrong, but like I felt like an idiot that I had not honored, again, my upbringing or the films that had shaped me earlier, right? I felt like, well, I needed to sit at the cool kids table because that will make it easier to have a career, to have a creative life. And it's really been, it's helped me refocus and re-identify maybe my path and what I want to do, all because of, you know, a horror movie.
Would you, I'm trying to dancing around spoilers here. There's a possibility for a sequel here. I think there's a possible Dolly universe, Dolly 2. I don't know what you want to call it. If you were to be given the opportunity to make a sequel to this film, how would you want to step it up? What's like the next step, you know, to get folks even get more walkouts, say? How do you do that?
We're not trying to get more walkouts. I would like it if people stayed and watch the movie. But you know, again, not in a cynical way, Dolly was designed with that in mind, right? Which was like, create original IP and maintain your ownership of it. Know where you want to head, like know where the horizon is and what needs to happen along the way, and then try to maintain that, right? Try to maintain that compass heading despite the stuff that you know, the storms and the bullshit that you have to go through on that path. So even when, you know, again, Dolly was constructed for the time and money we could have, just to say it out loud, it's set in the woods during the day with a few number of locations and a few number of characters. And the house originally, and this is not a spoiler, there's a house in the movie, you can see it in the trailer, was originally, yes, it's a little, well, this is a spoiler, sorry, but it's not a big spoiler. It's untethered from reality, maybe, you know, it's like a magical place, but the windows are all boarded up because it's a place that somebody cannot escape from. But the practical reasons for that initially was, well, maybe we could shoot inside of a house during daylight and not have to work an overnight if we black out the windows and make it so our characters can't leave. So we knew what we could do with the money we could find, start small, but with knowing exactly where these people came from, where Toby and Gail come from, like what Gail's mother wishes for, or Dolly's mother Gail wishes for, which is in the opening nursery rhyme that pops up on screen. We knew what all these things were. And then frankly, during the production of Dolly, I fell in love more with Ethan's character than I knew that I already was because of what Ethan was doing with the character. And so we also started realizing when people wanted to know more of what led this film to begin here and who these people were, I was like, well, now I know what my new compass heading is. And that's to understand why this family exists here and why they are who they are and why Dolly is the product of a wish, you know, and why Toby behaves this way and why Dolly has been nurtured this way. And so it's said at the end of the film, you know, in the credits, like, we'll see you again for Dolly 2. Again, plant the flag on the beach and like charge. And I was like, well, if I don't do this, it might not ever happen. Well, if I say it's happening, then maybe somebody will never doubt me and go, well, dude, this train's leaving the station. He's fucking doing a sequel. Like, holy shit. Like, well, let's get on that ride. And, so yes, it's that is all happening. I think to step it up, more days, more narrative and more lore and more mythology, like more storytelling, right? Dolly is a shotgun blast of insanity and, Gonzo style grindhouse, but I love stories and understanding human nature and the collision of opposing forces. And so growing Dolly from where it is now will be about that: more time, more money, more story, understanding the world and why these people are important to the, you know, the stories that I want to tell. So it's a long-winded answer. I got to shut up.
That's a fucking great answer. Sorry for swearing.
You guys are proper hosts and like you talk on podcasts all the time. I mean, you both have your own podcasts and I'm sitting here sweating uncontrollably going, I'm very long-winded.
No, I always joke that the ideal form of this show is me talking for 2 minutes and then everybody else talking for 10 or 12. Yes. Nobody wants to hear me. They're here for you guys.
They're here for Ethan. I'm just happy to be here.
Ethan, I want to just loop back to the theatrical question here for a second, because it's okay if I say you live in New York. That's
yeah, good. Sure.
Yeah. So you live in New York, which is a great, obviously great theater town, like, you know, movie theaters still thriving there, if not necessarily everywhere in the country. And, you know, taking this movie out to theaters around town has to be that has to be fun. But also it just there is a culture there that doesn't exist in lots of the rest of the country. How do we bring that to, how do we bring that love of movie theaters back into
the
rest
of
the world?
Sonny, I, you know, selfishly, since I was a little kid, I love movies. I love going to the movies. I want so desperately, and, you know, maybe I never do another movie again. Fine. I still want the opportunity to go watch movies in a movie theater. And like, this is another aspect to my interest in doing this with Rod, because the last movie we made together was very, very different. It breathes so slowly and so beautifully. It's like a long poem to a forgotten era of my childhood that was nostalgic about the way my parents existed. And then there's some gunshots in it too. So it's not, you know, but like, and to be completely honest with you, I don't watch horror movies. I cannot watch mm-hmm. horror movies. That's something that was ruined for me as a kid. However, I love that horror movies exist today, because they seem to be, other than big superhero movies, the only thing that people outside of me wants to go do as a group is go and watch these kind of movies. And so this opportunity for me is like, oh my God, I'm doing a movie that's not just going to be streaming on Netflix or Amazon. It's going to be in the theater. I got to go to a theater in Times Square last night that my wife and I were at 2 weeks ago, because I love movies so much, because I want to go to a movie at least once a week as like a point of pride, even though I don't love many of the movies being made today, you know, that are mm-hmm. in theaters. A lot of the movies that they're putting out on streamers, I wish were going to the theaters. Mm-hmm. I go to the Angelica, which is not far from my house, and I swear to God, the TV screen in my house is bigger than the screen in the movie theater. But I go to the Angelica, and me and my wife spend $50 to see a movie in a theater with other people. So, like, I want this to go on for myself, for my kids, for my grandkids, as something to do. And I do think it is done more here probably than maybe other parts of the country. We do have thriving movie theaters here. We have multiple Alamo draft houses. We have IPIX. We have lots of AMCs. We have lots of Regals. But I got to tell you, like, for me in the last year, the thing that made me happiest was that it took me 3 weeks to see Sinners because I couldn't find an open screen. And that might have pissed me off 20 years ago, but I was so like overjoyed that people were going out to the theaters. Not long ago, they played Elf in a movie theater. And I was so excited to take my granddaughter to see Elf in a movie theater. We were the only people in the theater. That broke my heart, mm-hmm. you know? So like getting to walk into a theater last night in Times Square with a full audience who cheered at the end of it, who are all there because they love doing this together, experiencing this together, it was so meaningful. It almost made me cry because like I don't get that. You know, the last time I saw a movie in a full theater was Sinners, and I almost cried then too, just because, and I like that movie. It's not my favorite movie, but it's a good movie. But like it was a full theater and like I'm experiencing something with other people, which is the point of going to the movies.
Yeah. I uh I want to tie this into something you said earlier. You just kind of mentioned working in TV is like having a 9-to-5. And
that's not to say there's lots of great TV being made too.
I'm not to denigrate TV at all. The TV now is better than ever, which is going to sound weird with what I say next, which is that TV now is also more flexible than ever is maybe the right word, in the sense of not just how people watch things, but also how they get made. I mean, you've been working in the industry for now, 35 years. You've worked on network TV shows. You've worked on feature films, big budget feature films, indie feature films, streaming shows, streaming movies. So you have the full gamut here. You've experienced it all. How has the industry changed from your perspective as a working actor for four decades or so, let's say? How has your perspective on the work that is being done and how it is being done changed?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, if you go back to like my origin story as an actor, I had a tangible picture of myself, and I'd staple a resume onto the back, which had mostly bullshit stuff that was made up on it about my abilities as like a horseback rider, which I couldn't do. And I would walk into places and hand that to somebody, and then I'd sit down with them and we'd have a short conversation or sometimes a long conversation, and then I'd run a scene with them. Nothing like that happens today. It's all Zoom. We're on Zoom right now. This is how the industry works now, is you get a sense of somebody through your computer screen, and then you wind up on set with them. TV's got a ton of money, but like, I don't know if we're getting the same amount of money for less content, because when we were making My Name is Earl, that cost $2.5 million an episode, and we were shooting 26, 27, I think one mm-hmm. season we shot 28 episodes in a year. And now maybe you get 8 episodes for about the same amount of money. So like as an actor, it's slightly bittersweet, because I think maybe you get to do better, you get better material that's maybe more well thought through, because they're going to tell an entire story in 8 or 10 episodes. Whereas for sure, by the end of 26 episodes, the writers are going like, the network is demanding 3 more episodes. What can we throw at them? And that's got to be tough. You know, for me, it's roughly the same amount of work, because we get more time to shoot it. And then I get to go and do movies, which is where I get to actually, other than this one show, you know, I loved making My Name is Earl. That was a lot of fun. But by the time mm-hmm. we shot 100 episodes of that, I don't need to play that character anymore. You know what I mean? But it seems like, for the most part, that's kind of the zone TV wants me to exist in, which is fine. And I can come and do movies where I'm like actually stretching my wings, so to speak. There's no autopilot in this character Toby I played. I had to like think about every moment that I was going to appear on screen and actually put, I don't want to say effort, maybe not the right word, but it was real work that paid off in me feeling like I had done something that I felt good about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
As far as like the technical stuff goes, I don't even know if networks make 25 or I don't even know if that exists, because the majority of the stuff I watch is on Netflix and Amazon right. and Apple TV. And that's all 10 or so episodes. Maybe the best, the one that does it the best is The Pit, because they give you at least 12 episodes, because it's a full day. And you're like, thank God for these 2 to 4 extra episodes. I want that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The Pit's a really interesting throwback. Not even a throwback. It's really kind of a hybrid of the you know, classic procedural type show with also the prestige trappings. It's really well done. It's just
I agree.
Fan.
We love The Pit. Yeah.
I think it's like the only show my wife and I watch on the day it comes out now. All right. Let's see what else. God, I have so many things I could ask. let's go one last question about Dolly here, Rod. So you have this movie, it's out now. It's going into theaters. Folks are seeing it. They have to spread the word. How do you build that community? How do you build that community of fans? I'm sure Shudder is doing lots of marketing, but I'm sure you are also doing, you know, your own kind of outreach and everything else. How do you build that community of fandom, you know, with all the tools you have and all the tools we have access to now? What is your strategy here for getting the word out?
I mean, I don't know if it qualifies as a strategy, but you know, borrow something from the wrestling world. I'm not a wrestling fan. I'm about to use or talk about it in a way that I do know what I'm talking about, but I know this from the wrestlers that I've heard talk about this. And we actually have a wrestler who plays our titular character, Dolly, who's a professional wrestler, Maxine Paler. But you know, the wrestling, ethos is like, no matter how many people show up, wrestle hard and give everyone a good show and say thank you. Right. Like, and that's what bands do too, right? Like, you know, there might be five people there, but if you play your heart out for those five bands and you show them you care, those five people might tell five people, and, you know, and you can easily see how the ball rolls downhill and picks up steam. And so I think for me, like I just try to truly thank people and be available to talk about the film, even if someone's critical about it, or like, cause I go, well, maybe I can learn from this. There's still time for me to apply a great idea, no matter where it comes from, to what we do next. And so I've just tried to be available to the people that are responding to it again, because I felt like that kid for so long who, you know, wanted to be heard and seen and maybe wasn't. And I'm going, wait a minute, these people are awesome and support me and care about me and the work I'm doing. So I just try to be available to them and to talk about it that way. I mean, also I will say, you know, again, having produced all of my own movies and having produced Dolly with my partners, Ross and Noah, like, again, it's creative entrepreneurship. At the end of the day, it is on us to be stewards of what we've created. And, you know, not that every creative person or, you know, front man or person that, you know, runs a company knows exactly what's best all the time. But I think if you've been developing an idea for so long, you have a pretty keen sense of like what would work and not work and how to, again, carry your project forward. And so I'm out there like trying to meet people and talk to people. I mean, I put together 2 AMAs on Reddit recently, one in the horror subreddit last week and on Friday in the movie subreddit, just on my own, right? I like, but it's the same way that I ever have done anything. Like when I was a kid, went to college in 1998, I wanted to make music videos. I didn't know anybody in the music business and the form felt accessible to me, right? I could imagine I could make a 4-minute movie, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just started cold calling record labels that had bands on their roster that I liked. And I would say, I've never made anything. I want to make music videos. You're probably not going to let me do that. But what I'll do in the interim is I'll go be a street team kid, like flyering and running the merch table or like literally collecting addresses for a mailing list. I was just like, I'm going to do the hard work because I want to be here. And it doesn't matter what that is. And so that's where I came from. And that's still what I'm doing to this day. I mean, most of the people I've now worked with, Ethan included, I've met in a non-traditional way. Like, I want to do things and I want to work with people I like and who are making choices and contributions that have had an impact on me and who I can glean a little bit about them as an artist and as a human. And I'm going to find a way to let that person know that I care about them and what they're doing. And hopefully they'll recognize my integrity and my honesty and then we'll find something to talk about. I mean, even Scoot McNairy was that way. I mean, I think this like, so now with Dolly, I'm just trying to do the same thing over and over again, because I don't take it lightly that I'm in this position where we're opening an 800 plus screens, which is insane for an indie film. And that's just in the US and Canada. We have wide Latin American distribution in every country starting in May. We have theatrical deals in England, Australia, Turkey, Germany, Spain, France, Scandinavia, Poland. Poland, they're making VHS tapes. And these are all deals we've managed to broker on our, you know, like, and we haven't sold the film. We still own the film. We own the IP. And so I'm going, I fucking did it, right? Like, it's been hard. It's been very hard. Don't get me wrong. But I'm right here, and there's a new chapter about to begin. And I've led us to this point, and I'm not going to stop. And I am tired. I'm very tired. And I need this to win, right? Like, because I've killed myself to get to this point. But like, there's no stopping now, right? Like, I can't let my foot off the gas. I've got the balls in the air. I'm just going to keep juggling because like, this is what I want to be doing. And I've worked my ass off to be here. And so I'll talk to every single person, like a wrestler who wrestles their hardest for two people that show up. Like I'm there doing that.
I have something to add to that too, Sonny. And especially because it affects, like if you're getting questions about like, how do you get money to make a movie? I assume aspiring filmmakers are listening to this. And I would just say like exactly what Rod talked about, how he's going to create an audience and a fan base for this. He is the exact same way at work. And I want to make sure that it's not misunderstood what I'm saying. Cause I've worked before for a full out communist who treated the set as though craft service should have a say in the dynamics of the scene, which drove me a little bit crazy because I want my director to have a point of view. I do not want it to be like, let's go consult the grips on whether I'm crying or not. This is not my point. But my point is Rod communicated with every other person on set in the exact same way that he communicated with me. He's clearly an empath. And so I think that he created an environment where there was no sense of people being ignored or looked past. He was very interested in everything everyone had to say about their jobs. And it was just the environments on his sets were unlike much of the movies I've been on, where I had a guy who knew what he wanted, who also made the time without seeming stressed out to allow me to communicate whatever I needed to communicate with him, but had that same relationship with everybody else down to the grips and craft services. And I think for people who want to make movies, the ability to talk and be interested in what other people are saying is very important, because you're not going to be able to generate a fan base. You're not going to be able to have a harmonious crew without that. And Rod really captures that ability. And I think it's innate, but it is something that could probably be learned by other people.
Let's stop there, because that's a very nice sign off there. If you've learned anything here, if you've enjoyed this interview, go find Dolly. It's playing near you. It's on 800 screens. It's a horror movie. So know what you're getting into. But it's fun. It's interesting. It's unique. It's original. It's an original movie in movie theaters, which is always a nice thing. Rod, Ethan, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonny.
Yeah, thank you, Sonny. Thank you, Ethan. You're very kind.
Thank you, Rod.
Everybody loving. All right. And my name, of course, is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.